If you've paid any attention to the news, you can see that the Western world is growing increasingly skeptical of globalization. During his campaign, U.S. President Donald Trump portrayed America as a big loser in international trade. Since being sworn in as president, he took his first action against trade liberalization by withdrawing America from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, effectively killing the agreement. Trump has also used outright bans of migration from select countries as a way to secure America's borders, and his proposed immigration policies could result in mass deportations. Of course, this trend is not just being seen in the United States. The United Kingdom's exit from the European Union could lead it to leaving the European single market. In France, the leader of the anti-immigration and anti-European Union party is leading the polls. All these changes are bound to have important ramifications for global development. If Western powers become more protectionist, what will that mean for the Sustainable Development Goals? How will the relationship between developing countries and the developed ones that support them change? Welcome to Talking Ideas. I'm Sherry Arnabi. In today's episode, we discuss these questions with someone who actively studies how to make global development cooperation work. His name is Homi Kharas, and he is a senior fellow and the deputy director of the Brookings Institution's Global Economy and Development Program.
Unfortunately, we've entered into a cycle where the policy environment, because of politics, is highly unstable and unpredictable. So none of us actually know who's going to be in charge and what they're going to be able to do and what their real policy agendas are. All of those are being torn up.
The bulk of this podcast was recorded before President Trump's inauguration. Since then, a draft executive order cutting U.S. funding for the United Nations and other international agencies, plus another withdrawing the U.S. from certain multilateral treaties, have surfaced, indicating that the Trump administration sees American support for global development as against its own interests. I got a quick Skype reaction from Homi Kharas on what this means for global development. Stay tuned till the end of the episode to hear his thoughts on that. Homi Kharas, thank you so much for coming on Talking Ideas. So the first question I wanted to ask you was that basically 2016, I think, will be known in history as a year of sort of global skeptic trends with Brexit, with the election of Donald Trump, with political parties in Europe that want to restrict immigration, gaining more power. To someone who's observing these trends, you know, how do you make sense of them? What do you think happened?
So I think that there's no question that there's been a great deal of disappointment with the economic performance of many of the advanced countries, not just with their aggregate growth rate, but also the way in which it's been distributed. And what I see is that it's become an easy explanation is to blame that disappointing performance on globalization. And so you do see political figures pointing the finger at globalization and saying that's the reason why things have been so poor. But I think we have to keep in mind that there's no real evidence that actually it is globalization that is resulting in these economic trends. And I would say that most economists would assign at least equal, if not more, blame, if you will, to technological progress. It's technology, really, that is displacing workers in manufacturing, not outsourcing to China. It's technology that is resulting in the growing inequality between those who have the skills to use and participate in the new information economy and those who do not. So this gap that you see in many countries between college-educated and less educated people is in terms of the incomes that they're earning is probably far more related to technology than it is to globalization. Of course, the two go together, so I don't think that one can separate them. But the reason why I emphasize this is because nobody is really suggesting stopping the path of technological progress in the same way as there are many policy proposals to try to block or at least slow down globalization. So I think it is going to be quite important in the future to understand what the real underpinnings are, and then also to recognize that perhaps economic explanations are not the real explanations at all. So many people talk about the fact that individuals always have some kind of a reference point, whether that's their parents, they feel good if they're doing better than their parents, whether it's their neighbors, or whether it's someone else. And I think that what we're seeing in the world today is that different groups are progressing at very different speeds. And in particular, in many emerging economies, China, India, even countries like Pakistan, growth rates are actually quite high, even by historical comparison. So people in the West see all of these countries growing, improving their living standards, doing much better, and they say, well, how come those people are doing so well and we're not? And that, I think, adds to their sense of disappointment. And, of course, it's linked and associated with geopolitical changes. So it used to be the case that if the U.S. and its Western European allies really decided on a certain course of action in world affairs, that's what would happen. There was control over the world, not just over their own countries and economies. Today, that's no longer the case. The U.S. is embroiled in wars in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, etc., but is unable to really impose its will and its vision for a new world order. So one sees all of these things, one senses this this loss of dominance of the old Western alliance in global affairs. And that probably also contributes to a certain sense that things are slipping out of control. And that, I'm sure, contributes a lot to feelings of disgruntlement amongst large parts of the population.
You authored a background paper that became a basis for the negotiations that led to the Sustainable Development Goals. What impact do you think global skeptic trends could have on achieving those goals?
I would say that in today's world, it is going to be harder to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, and it's going to be harder for a couple of reasons. First of all, economic performance across the world is worse than we had expected or anticipated. And at the end of the day, the Sustainable Development Goals require investment in a range of public services that require tax revenues, and tax revenues depend on economic growth and performance. Jobs depend on economic growth and performance, and both of those are in much shorter supply than we had thought. That is a very large problem. The growth rate in sub-Saharan Africa this year, for example, is one of the lowest that it's been. Some of the larger, more populous countries like Nigeria are actually seeing negative per capita growth rates. We will not be able to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals if with negative per capita growth rates. So I would say that's the principal reason. The second reason is that we're just in the just starting to understand the degree to which things have to change in order to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. we are going to need businesses to adopt new business models that incorporate concepts of the circular economy, concepts of sustainability, much more centrally into their way of doing business. This is no longer corporate social responsibility. And anytime you really talk about changes in behavior of large numbers of firms or people, it takes a long time to achieve. These are no longer just things that can be achieved by a simple stroke of the pen policy reform or persuading some finance minister to do one particular thing. These are large-scale systemic changes, and whether that involves the pricing of carbon and approaches to fossil fuels, whether it involves inputs like metals and minerals and the ways in which they're recycled, whether it involves food loss and food waste, which currently absorbs maybe one-third of all the food that's grown in the world. All of these things require changes in behavior, sometimes consumer behavior, sometimes business behavior, sometimes government behavior. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, as I said, we live in a very risk-averse world. People are unsure of themselves, and so they don't want to change. They don't want to risk bold new experiments. But without bold new experiments, we're not going to have the technologies that will allow us to leapfrog to achieve the sustainable development goals. We need to have electric cars. We need to have probably driverless cars. These are all brand new technologies where firms have to invest very significantly in developing working models. And firms will only do those investments if they believe that the policy environment is reasonably stable. And unfortunately, we've entered into a cycle where the policy environment, because of politics, is highly unstable and unpredictable. So none of us actually know who's going to be in charge and what they're going to be able to do and what their real policy agendas are. All of those are being torn up and replaced with exactly what is unclear. What we know is it's not what it was. That's been the platform on which many of these political figures have been running. It's against something rather than in favor of something. That is not a good environment for investment. And indeed, what you now see is many firms in Western economies and the United States sitting on very large amounts of cash simply because they're unwilling to commit to investments because they don't know what the future is going to bring. Mm-hmm. We have to change that if we're going to achieve the sustainable development goals.
Mm-hmm. And, particularly, I know that, achieving the SDGs and, greater development cooperation, that sort of multilateral institutions are going to play an important role, such as the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, World Trade Organization. How do you think they're going to be affected by this different policy environment that, from what we know now, seems to take a very different look at global cooperation?
I think all of these institutions face one major paradox, which is that just at the time when the need for them seems to have gone up, as you said, they have to play a much bigger role if the SDGs are to be met, if this, the way in which we manage the world economy is going to be more rules-based. So on the one hand, the needs have gone up. On the other hand, multilateralism as an instrument is in being seriously questioned by the major stakeholders. So whether that's the Europeans or the United States or others, they are not supporting wholeheartedly multilateral institutions to go out and play these roles. They're not giving them the money. They're not giving them the the operating space to take more risk. They're actually restraining. So we really don't know quite how that's going to shape up, whether ultimately the multilaterals will be unleashed and asked to go and do more and given the resources to do that, or whether the multilaterals will be seen as a black box into which, you know, national funds go, and what comes out is very unpredictable, and so they should be, you know, cut back. I'm sure that, you know, assessments will differ depending on the multilateral agency in question, but multilateralism as a system is by no means enjoying the kind of support that it should have, in my view, if these institutions are to play the expanded role that is being asked of them right now.
So is 2030 looking like a less achievable target date for meeting the Sustainable Development Goals, or?
I think that 2030 was always chosen as a date that is far enough to permit big forces like technological change to actually start to work their way through. You can get leapfrogging, you can get exponential change over that length of time, and yet not so far away that it just falls off the radar screen of policymakers. And so there are processes in place for policymakers to come and report on, you know, what they're doing and what's being achieved, etc. So I still feel that that's an important date because it does balance between those two. But I don't think that it's a date that should be thought of as written in stone. If we achieve the SDGs by 2031 rather than 2030, I think everybody would still applaud.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole purpose here is to really push the world to seek a different development path. And that's the whole world, not just developing countries, but also, importantly, developed countries. And I think that that's actually starting to happen, and at least some countries in Europe, such as Germany, the Nordics, are taking the Sustainable Development Goals very seriously and changing the way in which they think about their own domestic economic management and policies. And that's, I think, a very healthy sign. That's really what the SDGs were designed to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Let's say things don't pan out well. Let's say that this new policy environment that's less supportive of global goals, that's less supportive of global cooperation, let's say that it makes it much harder to achieve development progress. It makes it much harder to achieve, you know, the Sustainable Development Goals. Who do you think stands to get hurt the most if that happens?
Well, everybody will lose, but the people who will be hurt the most will obviously be the people in the poorest developing countries. And by and large, that means many countries in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, there's been tremendous progress, and people have been celebrating the reduction of poverty, extreme poverty across the world. But we have to still admit that the bar that we have set for extreme poverty, which is $1.90 per person per day, is still a very, very low bar. And at that kind of level, we will have more pandemic episodes coming out of these countries because they will not have health systems where surveillance can be done in time, and where the kinds of remedial actions to control pandemics can be put in place quickly enough. So everybody will be hurt. We will have more financial crises, because what we've seen with Greece is that even a relatively small country can actually have quite big impacts on much, much larger neighbors. We will have far more pressures on migration. we will have more people turning to crime, human trafficking, trafficking in species, animal species, so there will be losses of biodiversity and other things that at a certain point in time the world might need. All of these are global riches and global benefits. Terrorism, of course. And so, yes, we risk seeing a world where there is more of all of these global bads, because when the weak links in the chain, if you will, start to fail, it affects everyone. So I would say that poorest people will be affected most, in the sense that their aspirations for a better life will be dashed. But rich people also have the most to lose, and they will not live in a world that is safe. Safe in terms of health, safe in terms of terrorism, safe in terms of crime. So they will also lose.
Do you think anyone stands to benefit from global skeptic policies?
Well, in the very short run, certainly. You can see, for example, that oil companies can potentially benefit. But I suppose the question is, benefit for what? Profits might go up in the short run, but what are they going to be spent on? I think that we're at a point in time where we're witnessing many tipping points. We are seeing changes in temperatures in the Arctic and the Antarctic that were unprecedented. I suspect that these kinds of large, visible changes, increases in sea level, are going to be far more powerful drivers in changing public opinion than the science of projection. Now, unfortunately, that usually means that we put in place policies too late and suffer significant consequences. We've known for some time that preparedness usually costs something like 1/10 to 1/50 of dealing with the aftermath of a crisis, and yet we don't have the political will to actually prepare properly for a number of different things. But for sure, sea levels are going to start to rise. That is going to affect many cities. Big cities like New York are built right there on the sea. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to put in place some very significant infrastructure improvements just to safeguard what they have. Well, all of that is what economists call sunk cost. It's just expenses that don't result in a benefit. They result in not having a loss.
Literally sunk costs.
They are literally going to be sunk costs, because they will probably have to be below the waterline.
But even, the people who, elected or, voted for these global skeptic politicians and policies, I mean, do you think they will get benefits from policies that, reduce the number of jobs that are outsourced, or penalties on companies that outsource jobs, or claim that they can bring back old manufacturing jobs to home? Would they see any positive spike in their well-being?
I suspect that that's going to be difficult. Many of these places are in communities where the principal source of business has just gone. The long-run solution is migration and for people to move, but people don't like to move from their homes. They and their families have been there for generations, and they would rather stay where they were born. So you do see this divide between the urban areas, which are actually doing not so badly and where there are jobs and new opportunities and other things, and smaller towns and villages and obviously rural areas. I think in today's economy, which is changing very rapidly, all kinds of technological change, it's the economics of place that is most important. And some places no longer have a viable economic base. What you do with people who don't want to leave those places is a major social issue.
Mm-hmm. And are there any other major concerns you have as far as how this sort of political shift will affect development, cooperation, and global goals?
I think there's actually a very healthy new development in development cooperation. And that is that businesses are becoming more involved, universities are becoming more involved, the role of science is being emphasized, and obviously individuals, whether through civil society organizations or otherwise, are also becoming more involved. We seem to live in a much more activist world, and one of the things that gives me sense of optimism is the way in which artists and chefs and small businesses and entrepreneurs and IT coders and others are starting to get involved in trying to change the course of development, especially in their own countries and in developing countries. And I'm convinced that these kinds of interventions will make a huge difference. The old model of development cooperation as basically being government to government is becoming far less important. Mm. And, governments are never renowned for their efficiency. And so when you've got government to government, so you've got a couple of governments involved, efficiency goes down even more. So it was never the case that the old development cooperation model was working terribly efficiently. I believe that it did a considerable amount of good. But there are now so many more forms of development cooperation that are happening that I'm actually very optimistic that taken as a whole, we will see much more what I would call mutual solidarity mm-hmm. across the world.
So in a sense, it's sort of that, maybe the multilateral organizations and governments might be a little more constrained, but civil society, as you think, is still strong and committed.
Civil society, but more than civil society, I think, what businesses are doing. And
right, including businesses.
They are changing their business models. And what universities and scientific establishments are doing.
Okay.
And I think that's also something which is very new, whether it's, engineering schools or architects or others. Obviously, for many years now in medical science. In agricultural science, the advances in all of these areas are considerable, and the interest in thinking about sustainability in each of these disciplines has shot up enormously. And the ability to then share those solutions and experiences across borders has also increased enormously. So mm-hmm. there's much more transfer of knowledge, much more understanding of what the critical problems are, and then devoting of brain power of graduate students and professors, etc., to trying to solve those problems. So I'm quite optimistic that we will have some breakthroughs, and when we do, the impact will be enormous.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, in terms of this policy shift bringing uncertainty when it comes to global development cooperation, for someone who's in the midst of all this uncertainty, what do you think would be the best ways to adapt to all these changes?
Well, I think that it's important to keep basing one's interventions on evidence. And so, yes, there's a lot of uncertainty, but what one can do is continue to try to say, this is what we find is working, this is what we find is not working, this is where there are gaps. And if one can much more systematically map out areas where it's easy to make progress based on existing technologies, areas where we need to invest much more in terms of research, areas where we can do experiments of different kinds in order to find out what we need to know. That's how I hope we'll start to proceed. And many of the much of information technology now permits that to take place on a far greater scale than ever before.
We are back with Homi Kharaas post-inauguration, just to hear his thoughts on some important developments that have happened since President Trump has been sworn in. A draft of an executive order has surfaced that cuts U.S. funding for the UN and other international bodies by 40%. Another draft withdraws the U.S. from multinational treaties that are not directly related to international trade, extradition, or national security. How does this development change your assessment of whether we can achieve global goals and what the future of multilateral engagement with the developing world will look like?
I mean, certainly, I think that the signals coming from the new administration are that their confidence in multilateral institutions and their ability to make a contribution to the global goals is much less than previous administrations, and that seems to be reflected in the drafting of these new executive orders and other things. The details of what those will be in practice are obviously still to be worked out. Nevertheless, I do think that they are a reasonable reflection of the going-in assumption of the new administration. And that clearly is something which will be of some concern to all of the multilateral institutions. There are a number of things that the U.S. Might do. So in the the worst fears are that because contributions to multilateral institutions involve a very delicate sharing of the burden among countries, if one major player like the United States decides it doesn't like its share of the burden and starts to try to renegotiate it, many other countries might say, well, in that case, we're also going to renegotiate, and you get a situation in which things start to unravel very quickly. You can't just assume that if one country unilaterally cuts back, that all other countries will stay the same. With the financing of multilateral institutions, these things have been in the past a negotiated agreement on equitable burden sharing. So it does risk that those agreements start to unwind, and that could be quite serious because it then puts the multilateral institutions in very uncertain terrain and essentially halts them from doing the job that they've been set up to do. But let me also add that there are many other things outside of just their contributions to multilaterals where the world depends on U.S. leadership. So as just one example, the amount that the U.S. spends on research into climate change is, is huge. And if the U.S. decides to stop spending on research into climate change, just bilateral research, that would have a an enormous impact on the global research endeavor. And what we should bear in mind is that the Sustainable Development Goals, the Climate Change Agreement, many of these things, ultimately are as ambitious as they are because of a confidence that technology will help us generate solutions at a much more rapid rate than in the past. So we're looking not just at the technologies that exist today, but the technologies that we believe we'll be able to deploy prior to 2030. And that requires a continued level of investment in research. If investment in research dries up or slows significantly, then we may not get those new technologies coming into play, and that could have some serious implications for achievement of the SDGs.
So if we start seeing a bit of an undoing of the international system that governs multilateral organizations and development cooperation between countries, how do you think people working in this sphere, whether they are project managers, researchers, or policymakers, should adapt to the new reality?
Well, I think that what you're describing is a world in which every country then becomes essentially responsible for trying to achieve the goals on their own. Mm-hmm. What you're describing is a world where development cooperation as a global initiative starts to break down. Now, for some countries, especially, you know, relatively large, sophisticated countries, that may not make that much of a difference. But for many other countries, particularly countries in fragile environments where sometimes you need some impetus from the outside in order to change things because the domestic situation is so precarious and fragile that countries can't do it by themselves, the worry is that those countries won't be able to escape from the traps, if you will, that they themselves have, that they've created for themselves. That's going to be the difficulty that we'll face, and where development cooperation in the past was organized in part to try to help those countries escape from those traps by providing a force that was outside of the pure domestic, both political and economic forces.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Talking Ideas. Talking Ideas is produced at the Institute of Development and Economic Alternatives, or IDEAS for short, where I work as a communications coordinator. IDEAS conducts research on a wide range of topics pertaining to development in Pakistan, including education, finance, law, and governance. You can see our work at ideaspak.org. Thanks for listening.